Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Investing with IBD Podcast. It's Justin Nielsen here, your host, and it is January 24th, 2024. And for those of you watching the video, you might notice that Arusha Paris looks a little bit different today. We are actually joined by Scott St. Clair. He is the IBD Premium Products Manager. How you doing, Scott?
I'm good. I'm always having to step in and clean up Arusha's mess.
Yes, a little bit. But I only think it's fair because last week you were out for the webinar that we did with Mark Minervini, something that's available at investors.com. So I stepped in for you. Now, well, wait, no, you're not stepping in for me, but yeah. You have in the past. So let's.
And you did
let's
really
call it even.
Good. Yeah, I wish you hadn't done so well, honestly. So I heard how great your webinar was with Mark, and I kept telling everybody, well, that's because Mark's so good.
That's what I was telling him too, but you know, it certainly is something that we do for each other. And also joining us for the first time on our lineup here is Stephen Mulholland. Stephen is from the Mulholland and Cooperstock Group. He's the chief investment officer there. Of course, they also have an ETF, MKM. We'll talk a little bit about kind of that strategy that they have for that ETF, but Stephen, it's really great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Justin. Good to meet you, Scott. And no affiliation to Mulholland Drive, but it's nice to be here with some right. some Orange County guys today.
Yeah. There was a little bit of talk in the pre-show. Scott St. Clair and Stephen were kind of talking about their Irvine interests. And we got into some mascots too for college, which
go Anteaters.
Go Anteaters. So,
well, let's get right into it. We're kind of starting a little bit out of order today because we wanted to get Stephen on to get some thoughts, a little bit of contrarian thoughts. I mean, you know, a lot of people are just looking at the market right now and saying go, 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 especially with the Fed out there kind of suggesting with the last couple meetings, hey, you know, it's the cutting is around the corner, you know, looking at the dot plot, everything like that. So, Stephen, let's just kind of get your take real quick on your approach, and then kind of your thoughts on what's happening with the Fed. So first of all, your approach, you know, what kind of would you say is your investing style?
Thank you for that question. And just as a preview, I think the Federal Reserve always thinks they're doing a great job right. Until something blows up. So,
and I think everyone thinks that they're not doing a great job pretty much for the most part.
Very,
you know, they can always be doing better.
Very true. So my approach to investing is what I've learned over my institutional investment career, which is simplify things, pay attention to what matters, and that tends to be trend and valuation. And there's often investors are in one school or the other. They're both incredibly important. So to connecting it to today's market and the ETF, I've been in the institutional investment world for, since 2001. And what I've learned are what we've done with the ETF is try to embed the key signals of trend and valuation in the ETF. And you're right. If you're contrarian and wrong, it's terrible. If you're contrarian and right, it's wonderful.
You're a genius.
You're a genius.
You saw what no one else did.
That's right. And I think what I love about trends, my makeup is much more on the valuation side, right? Whether you're looking to buy a house or stocks or bonds, what's the fundamental case? Looking at the cash flows, evaluating a business. But the market is very smart, and I really love the overlay with trends. And when it gets interesting is when the trends and valuation agree or disagree. Mm-hmm. And in this market, to your point about contrarianism or confusion, trends and valuation disagree.
Mm-hmm. So maybe you could talk a little bit more about that. So what are you kind of using as your sense of why you think valuations are out of whack right now?
So we take a Bayesian approach to valuation. So anyone who follows sport,
what is a Bayesian approach? You know, for those that maybe don't remember their stats.
That's a great question, and I'd encourage any listeners to ask ChatGPT that question.
Okay, perfect.
Which I did ahead of this podcast, and it gave a really good answer. So all it means is that you have a probability when your period starts, and then you update it as new information becomes available. Keeping the analogy in mind of sports, whether you like baseball, the NFL, hockey, soccer, before a game starts, really smart people in Las Vegas handicap the game. And they say, you know, hey, the Lions are underdogs, right? So if you go through the first or second quarter and the Lions are crushing the opponent, one interpretation is, oh, the bookies were wrong and they didn't know anything. The other interpretation is the second half might be tough for the Lions and it'll regress closer to the prediction, right?
Everyone might have priced that in.
They might have priced that in, and you just might have to wait for the whole game to unfold. Well, our approach to the valuation is exactly the same. So every good investor knows institutions, Warren Buffett, you can make really good forecasts on a valuation basis for the next 10 years or 20 years. Robert Shiller showed that very well when he came out with his cyclically adjusted PE ratio or CAPE. The rub is, all good investors know, that tells you almost nothing about the short term. So the riddle that was actually initially proposed by Ben Stein, which some of the listeners might know, was how can you make a prediction that's accurate for 10 years, but tells us nothing about the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. After all, if the forecast you made in 2013, 14, and 15, well, when you get to 2024, you've run through 7, 8, 9 years of your forecast. So what we do is we look at that stub period as our explanatory variable. We don't look at what the CAPE is today. We look at how much the market's overshot or undershot reasonable expectations for models that have very high predictive power, or for our statistically inclined listeners, R squareds of 0.8 or 0.9. So the next, I can see, Justin, your furrowed eyebrows. So I'm going to fill in the next part of the thought, which is if you look at, and you've pulled up the perfect slide for anyone following online, watching on YouTube, the S&P 500 has overshot its 10% average that we all know and well over the last 5 years, 6 years, 7 years. So in very simple terms, when the S&P generates 15% a year returns over the last 5 years, as it recently has at the end of 2023, that gets people really excited. In fact, a survey was done recently that polled individual investors and said, what do you expect the S&P to deliver in the future? Well, guess what? They picked the exact number that we've observed in the last 5 years, 15%. Now, when you ask institutional investors, what did they pick? Well, they're no better. They just have a slightly longer time horizon. They pick 7%. What's 7%? Well, that's the annualized return for the S&P of this millennium. Since 2000 to 2023, the S&P's done 7%. Why did it do 7%? Because everybody got really excited about dot-com tech, Microsoft. Stop me if any of this sounds familiar. They got really excited about Amazon in 1999, 2000, and set us up for lackluster returns. So rather than just look at recent history, although that's very tempting and we all do it a little bit, as long as humans are investors, we're all going to overemphasize our personal experience. We look at the miss of the forecast. We're in the third quarter. We know what a good forecast was before the game started. So we use that forecast for the fourth quarter. And what our model says is institutions here are closer to what's likely to unfold in the near future of 7. And if you look at Vanguard's expected returns for the S&P, there's a bit of a range, but the midpoint's about 5%. So 15%, very optimistic. Historical average 10, probably even a little optimistic. And the reason that we agree with Vanguard is because our Bayesian model says we've overshot. We've already earned the future returns in the last 3, 4, and 5 years. We've pulled ahead future returns.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to bring Scott in here a little bit. So, you know, a lot of times you and I, we're just looking at the chart, right? And how does this kind of, I know that you listen to a lot of macro and you're fascinated by the macro aspect. What's kind of your take on the valuation story of things?
I love to read it. I love to study it, but I find that it almost always, and Stephen might be able to confirm this, goes on much, much longer than even the staunchest, smartest, most experienced investors could ever imagine. And there's a difference between being right and making money, but there's also career risk. And somebody who was in the business in a number of ways, you have to kind of be right, and you have to kind of be right at certain, you know, you have a certain amount of window to be right. So I would say, how does he tackle that being right, but also being there when it switches? You got to be there to participate, you know, versus, you know, not being in the business anymore, right?
I run an advisory in addition to the ETF, and I couldn't agree more, especially with the career risk point. That one hits home. If Justin, if Justin could skip ahead to the four colored boxes in the slides, or Mike, whoever has major control of the slides, mm-hmm. If they could skip ahead to the green, red, yellow. Perfect. So, Scott, kind of to answer that question, for listeners, I'll size up what this chart is. But in March of 2009, when the S&P bottomed ominously at 666, we were in the upper left quadrant, which was we had incredible expected returns. We had incredible expected returns and bad trends, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to convince someone to buy the stock market. I mean, Warren Buffett did it. Then President Barack Obama did it. But it took a lot. They needed a PR campaign. People said, you know, this stock market, it's not for me. Unfortunately, I know people personally, firefighters, otherwise, who said, you know what, I'm done with the stock market. I can't take this kind of a roller coaster ride if it's going to go this low.
Yeah, a 57% drawdown, you know, if you were in the S&P 500.
57% drawdown. And if you were close to retirement, you know.
Devastating.
I'm glad you put it in those terms, Justin. I mean, in the chart, right, we lose the emotions of it. But, you know, if you knew people going through that, if you had a 401k, yeah, 57% is devastating. So March 2009, we started upper left, bad trends, expected returns. Evaluation guy, Seth Klarman, Warren Buffett was salivating, right? A trend guy, John Henry, the hedge funds that use momentum were saying, hey, not quite yet, right? We quickly moved from the upper left quadrant, which, if you will, to paint a picture for our listeners, imagine you're in Seattle, one of my personally favorite cities in the United States. Pretty quickly, we moved east to New York City, and we had great expected returns and wonderful trends. And that persisted from 2009 to about 2017 or 18. And I had a lot of clients of mine in New York. I managed a hedge fund, but I also had individual clients. They were terrified. You know, are you sure we can invest in the stock market? Are you sure it's safe? Meredith Whitney just said the municipals are in trouble. They're going to go bankrupt. America's going to go bankrupt. In retrospect, it seems like a no-brainer, but there used to be headlines running the Investor's Business Daily, other periodicals that said, you know, the most hated bull market in history, the most ignored bull market in history. We all wondered in 2017 and 18, did everybody miss it? Why didn't people get more excited about the stock market? It seemed largely over. The Fed tried to raise interest rates. The president used his Twitter bullpit very well to get the Fed to lower interest rates. It was a brief hiccup, but then we were back to the races. So to answer your question, Scott, we moved from Seattle to New York. It was only really recently, actually right before COVID, we moved further south to the danger zone, which I like to think of as Florida. It was still sunny, but there were sharks and alligators in the water.
Hurricanes.
So this is it, according to our model, and this is why we use the Bayesian approach rather than being slavish, because GMO, I don't want to call anybody out individually, really respected valuation managers. If valuation is your core thesis and you don't incorporate trend, you were jumping out of the market way too early. It's a big reason why we use trends and charts as well. So we're in Florida and we're still in the stock market, but we say, hey, we need to start to be a little careful. And the thing to really watch out for is when you go from Florida back to Southern California, the land of wildfires, and earthquakes is only about 14% of the time since Alan Greenspan became Fed chair. It's only been 14% of the time that we've had, according to our model, and we can get into this more if Justin Scott or anyone's curious, only 14% of the time have we had bad technicals and bad expected returns. That's 2001, that's 2008. And interestingly, our model said the market was overvalued by about 20% right before COVID. Obviously, our model didn't know about COVID, but when it happened, the market was already vulnerable. And today the valuation is back to the same using our model as it was pre-COVID, pre-01, pre-08. So the reason our ETF is still 50% in the S&P 500, not zero, is because of the trends. But when the trends and the valuations agree, and again, it's not a perfect prediction. There are some false indicators, but for investors who can't stomach drawdowns of 20 to 50 or 60%, investors who make regular withdrawals, or investors, you know, for those investors, we're still in the yellow zone, not the red zone. For us, it's still okay to have exposure to the S&P, but it's a good idea to lighten up. So that's when we would be concerned, is when John Henry and Warren Buffett or Seth Klarman agree, that's when you should be nervous. And I will add, it ties to another slide we have after this, we can pull up now or later, which is the U.S. Market cap is 60% of the world. 40% of the world, with the exception of Netherlands and India, is fairly valued or significantly undervalued, right? So there's also an opportunistic side to this, that investors can still earn 8 to 10% or higher returns in a lot of really good markets around the world. Japan's personally one of our favorites. You can also get 5% risk-free in treasury bills. That hasn't been true for 15 years. The career risk, I guess it's also a career opportunity, although I've definitely been exposed to both. The opportunity is, if you can avoid those 20, 30, 40, 50% drawdowns and still compound at material rates, we've also found that to be quite popular with clients as well.
And it's funny that you mentioned the whole international scheme here, because we were just talking on our show earlier today on IBD Live, and this is something that's come up a few times. Scott St. Clair has been, very interested in a lot of these international areas, Japan especially, but Poland, Brazil, Latin America. I mean, he's kind of, run the gambit. The joke has been, Arusha, who usually is guest hosting with me, has been that, he's been trying this for a while, hasn't been successful at it. A lot of people have been kind of, international, it's overdue to happen, but it hasn't. So, again, I think to Scott's point earlier, it's the timing, right? You can be right, but if you're too early, sometimes that's even worse. So what's your take on that, Scott?
Yeah, everything he said just resonates with me. And, and my career risk is, firing myself, right? Which I joke.
Unlikely to happen. You like yourself a lot.
Yeah, I haven't fired myself in 25 years, but there's been some years where I probably should have fired myself. That's the I say that only slightly tongue in cheek, but
at least giving yourself a leave of absence, suspended.
So I can try, an ETF, and I've owned an ETF in Poland, EPOL, and I currently own the Japanese ETF, and I've tried Brazil and few times futilely. It hasn't hurt me, but it hasn't helped me. But I think the world is getting smaller and smaller by the minute, it's both good and bad. And as an investor, there's some great company. I mean, most great companies are in the U.S. obviously, but ASML comes to mind as a great, great, fantastic company.
Although I will say that Stephen and I, when we were talking earlier, Netherlands wasn't on your,
it's probably overvalued. Yeah. ASM is probably overvalued, of course, but to his point about trend, the trend is, at least the way I would interpret it, very much up. So, yeah, I a lot of this makes sense to me and is appealing for sure.
Before we kind of wrap up, I do also want to kind of revisit the Fed idea, and I'm gonna go to your slide that is related to the Fed and what you call the Fed Mistake Index. Can you describe this a little bit?
Yeah, that's great. I could use both of your help, because if you Google the Fed Mistake Index, nothing comes up.
Right, exactly. So, yeah. I tried to do that.
Man. Yeah, yeah.
After we talked about it.
No, and it's actually born from conversations. I'm going to give my brother a big shout out here. My twin brother runs the second largest commodity mutual fund in the country, or Credit Suisse. He's launching his own commodity hedge fund. But he coined the term Fed Mistake Index. So feel free to popularize its okay. name. But I think it's great. And what it does, so simple terms, it's the effective Fed funds rate. And you could use 3-month treasury bill, effective funds rate, official policy rate. What it does is it takes the difference of the Fed funds rate and the 2-year treasury, right? The 2-year treasury, you could fire the entire Fed and hire the treasury market. And the 2-year treasury does a great job of telling the Fed where the Fed funds rate should be, right? Jeff Gundlach always says the best predictor of the Fed funds rate is the 2-year rate. So what the Fed Mistake Index does, takes the difference. Today it's plus 100, meaning the effective Fed funds rate is 5.38. And the 2-year was 4.33, I think. 4.38, effective funds rate is 5.33. The average is minus 50 basis points. So 100 and the 50 gives you, the Fed should cut 150 basis points. And if they do, the Fed funds rate will be exactly in line with the historical 3-month treasury yield, with the historical Fed funds rate. Banks can't make money when the curve is inverted, right? The banks just reported very poor earnings. The street expects 9% earnings growth for financials in 2024. That's going to be very hard with an inverted yield curve, right? I'm sure Scott and Justin will agree with this. Hopefully Mike behind the scenes, but my mortgage rate is 2.85, right? I just checked Mortgage News Daily and it's down from the highs, but it was 6.95 today, right? 6.95 might be less than 8 or 9. It's a lot higher than 2.85, right?
Yeah.
So even though the market has confounded critics, right? And for really good reasons, right? American corporations and consumers are really resilient. Companies were very wise to lock in their debt before the Fed raised their interest rates. Homeowners made sure to lock in their mortgages. All these things have delayed, plus excess COVID cash, have delayed the economic reaction a lot of smart people were expecting. But eventually it's going to bite into the economy. So if the Fed wanted to pull off their soft landing, which, as someone has pointed out, in 2007, we had a soft landing before the crash, right? It always feels like a soft landing. And very ominously, if you compare the Fed Mistake Index now, and it's on your chart, to right before the big recession of 2008, you can see, and anyone watching online can see, we peaked in 2001 and 2008 right around 100 basis points. And without looking for parallels to the Great Financial Crisis, there are myriad similarities in the commodities market, in the stock market, in the Fed Mistake Index. So if I were advising the Fed, I would just say, listen to the treasury market. You know, it's obviously more distorted than it was historically, but the treasury market's pretty smart. If I were the Fed, I would cut 150 basis points, and I think that would increase the odds of a soft landing. The longer they feel comfortable and the slower they go, the higher the odds go that we get another repo quake, or, you know, so we find out some hedge funds are using too much leverage to arbitrage the reverse repo market, the treasury market, you know, East Asian crisis for our listeners that have been in the market for a while, you know, something blows up somewhere, right? The Fed is offsides, and they should stick to cutting sooner than later by 150 basis points.
Well, and if they were doing it nice and slow, as they tend to, I mean, that's certainly not the way we're ramped up. We had a number of, you know, 50 basis point hikes, but that would be six quarter point. And I mean, that's what a lot of people are expecting. But then on the other hand, I mean, I look at if the Fed cuts six times, that's usually when there's trouble. That's usually when, like, oh, we're kind of in panic mode. We need to really do something because, you know, things are breaking. I mean, and they're usually late, right? That usually happens after some crisis has already started unfolding. So
You see that in the chart. If you go back a few years, you see how low we got, right? That's when the when everyone was screaming to the Fed, hey, you need to raise rates, right? And they said, well, we don't see inflation. What's that, right? And you can see that meant that they had to raise by more than they should have later. So exactly to your point, they were too slow before, and they're kind of too slow now. And I think the Fed thinks they're doing us a service by doing all these interviews and over communicating, right? You remember Greenspan used to show up and people said, how big's his briefcase? Is he in a good mood? Right. There might be something to that. I personally would like to have the Fed less operate like a reality TV show. Right. And you know, they're data dependent. Well, they should be paying more attention to the market. And I agree, the sooner they act, then the less they'll have to overreact later, and hopefully the less of a mess they'll have to clean up. And if I could add, and this is just a hope, this isn't an expectation, I really hope we don't go back to zero. It would be nice if they set a floor of somewhere around 2% or so.
Mm-hmm. A little bit more normal, you know, because again, zero was very abnormal. I mean, 2% is still low, but it's not zero, which is where we were for a while. Hey, Stephen, it was really, really a pleasure chatting with you today. I'm really glad you came on. Thank you so much for joining us. And where can folks kind of find out more information about your thoughts and, you know, read some of your blogs? I found some of those interesting. Where do you suggest they go?
MKMETF.com. And then we also have a Substack, which is Inbox CIO for Chief Investment Officer.
Awesome. And then are you on Twitter at all or anything like that?
I'm taking a long Twitter break and I'm really enjoying it.
I don't blame you. Well, thanks again for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Okay. When we come back, Scott and I are going to start talking a little bit about the market, kind of digest some of what we learned from Stephen, and then we'll get into some stocks. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This message is brought to you by Nuveen. Nuveen has provided investment excellence for 125 years. A lot has changed, but one thing that remains constant, including the different types of durable income and portfolios, can help investors meet their goals. With expertise across income and alternatives, Nuveen continues to expand its capabilities while maintaining its legacy as a leading investment manager. Visit Nuveen.com to learn more. Investing involves risk. Loss of principal is possible.
Welcome back to the Investing with IBD podcast. It's Justin Nielsen, your host, and joining me as my special co-host today is Scott St. Clair. He is the IBD manager of premium products, especially well-versed in MarketSmith. It's one of those things where you're not only the manager of premium products, but you were also a client for a lot of years back in the day. So that's kind of how he got his job. For those of you that don't know his story, I should also recommend highly that, you know, if you are a MarketSmith member, there's some great webinars and things educational in nature that MarketSmith is doing all the time. You know, Scott, you've got your own kind of weekly thing that you do, your take on the market, to wrap up the week every week. And that's great stuff there. So we're going to kind of get like an early preview, maybe to a degree.
Yeah.
And kind of go through the market a little bit here. I mean, if we just pull up the NASDAQ right now, things started off really nice, but that's not how they ended. So maybe talk a little bit about what you're seeing out there.
So I guess the jury's still out on the volume, but today might have been a stalling day. Can you confirm nor deny that fact?
You know what? It does look like it to me. It's still, you know, when you're up, you know, when you're up 0.36%, that's still a pretty good gain.
Still the gain.
Yeah. So, but you know, 0.4 for market school purposes, 0.4 is what starts disqualifying it as like, oh, it's up too much. But, you know, we have had a little bit of lower volatility lately. So, you know, that's the one thing that kind of makes me feel a little bit funny. It's certainly not a good look, right? When you are up that much and you give it all away. And, you know, the volume, again, a lot of times for stalling, we don't necessarily need it to be above the previous day. There were some cases where Bill actually said, okay, 95% of the volume was there. But in all of those cases, he was kind of looking at, you know, the situations where it was really big volume the day before, and it continued to be big volume, but it was 95%. So there's a lot of like nuances there. Bottom line, whether it's technically stalling or not, it wasn't a good look, right?
Yeah, it felt like, you know, all of the usual suspects felt a little stallish today. Nvidia, SMCI, those are the two that I focus on the most, because the, you know, we always focus on the ones we own. So, I'm always looking around the corner, fortunately or unfortunately. When you've had as much experience as me, things can change from good to bad and from bad to good. Look how quickly this market changed from bad to just an incredible bull market. And so I'm always wary and aware that, you know, things can change the other way. I kind of keep that, not necessarily in the back of my mind, but, it's something that I'm acutely aware of, fortunately or unfortunately. It's just kind of the way I trade. So yeah, it feels like the market's been so good. Like, as strange as that sounds, that bothers me. Yeah. I don't know why, but it's
good.
It's like, it's been so good. And then the leadership is great. There's canned slim type stocks with big earnings and sales, SMCI pre-announces, the stock goes up tremendously. And so the market's humming on all cylinders at this point, but it's a long year. It's only January 24th. So, anything can happen. I mean, just last year, in March of last year, was the banking crisis, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We were worried that the banks were, you know, they were going to start falling like flies. So, yet last year had so many different things happen. And so anything could happen for this year.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, again, if we kind of just put this in the context, look, we had a big move off of the bottom from, 2022. I mean, really, if you look at kind of this October area, in 2022, was really kind of the bottom. And of course, that was a little bit of a shift in, it was the worst CPI ever, but it's kind of like, that's as bad as it got, right? With inflation. We had such a big move off the bottom, topped here in the summer. And now, this was as brutal as this was, it was still a higher high overall, not on the short term here, but, in this longer term trend. And then we've really kind of, jumped off the bottom here from October of 2023. And, a lot of people are pointing out, how many weeks up in a row is this? I mean, it's like, what, 11 weeks out of 12 up in a row? We had something similar back here, into the summer of 2023. But is that sustainable, is, I guess, the question. And for how long? How much more do you want out of it before it takes a break?
Correct. It's such a difficult dance that we do between taking profits, selling into strength, and allowing the stocks room to breathe. If you're going to have a model book stock, you're going to have to let it pull back 20-25% a number of times. And, some of us are really good at one and not very good at the other, and, or vice versa. So, I would just say, know what you're good at, know what type of trader/investor you are. And, adjust accordingly. Like right now, it doesn't look like anything could go wrong. So I would say, okay, build that in. What would you do if Nvidia went down to the 50-day in 12 out of 15 sessions? Mm-hmm. Things like that seem unlikely, but gosh, every time you think something's unlikely in the stock market, it becomes likely. It's really so dynamic.
Mm-hmm. And, let me just get your take here real quick, because again, there's often we make these comparisons to sports and, what inning are we in? A lot of people are saying, hey, we're in early, early innings right here, because, if you take it from this October low of 2023, it seems like, oh, we just started. But if you take it from October 2022, then it feels like a little bit more little later in the game. So where are you kind of taking it as our start here?
That's a very good question. I guess if you force me to answer, I would say the start was the lower part.
October 2022.
Nvidia broke out back then. I mean, there was very few breakouts, but
Well, and I guess I'm going to throw another wrinkle in there and throw up RSP because, you know, as strong as the NASDAQ looked, that's not what the equal weighted S&P 500 looked like. So for most stocks, that's not what they looked like. That was just, you know, the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ looked very different from most stocks, let's say.
Yeah, and that's part of the thing, the narrowness of the rally that people talked about, which kind of became like an excuse for lack of participation on their part, I guess. Right. Yeah. Because honestly, there's a lot of great stocks. If you did any kind of year-to-date or last 12 months screen in MarketSmith, there's, you know, there's home builders, there's coal AMR.
Yeah.
There's a lot of industrial, you know, companies that contribute to the home building segment, like Top Build or BLD. I'm just throwing names out mm-hmm. there that, look, I didn't have any of those, but I mean, they're out there. So mm-hmm. I don't think the market was as narrow as people claimed it to be, at least in my universe or in our universe where, you know, I'm looking to own 8-10 great stocks in a perfect world. It's not always like that, of course, but if you only need to own 10, 12, even let's say 20 stocks, they were out there for you. You just had to do some digging and be open-minded to what you were seeing.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't a situation where you had, you know, the current going with you and, you know, kind of pushing you along and a little bit more forgiving of mistakes as it is now. It was a little bit more like, okay, you know, you had to pick the winners. You had to really kind of narrow in on what was truly happening out there and kind of and sometimes squelch the noise, because if you just went by headlines, that was not telling you necessarily where to be at the right time. But, you know, to your point, I mean, even during the bear market, you know, as bad as the NASDAQ looked, I mean, oil stocks had a phenomenal right. move during that time. And yeah. So I see what you're saying. I mean, really, it's probably in between. You know, it wasn't as, you know, there were those stocks out there. So, you know, as you said, it wasn't kind of as bad as people were saying it was, but maybe it wasn't as good either as the indexes were showing, you know, because of what was happening with the Magnificent Seven.
Yeah. And the indexes, for lack of a better term, in my humble opinion, have become a bit of a flawed product in that regard, because they are so top heavy. You know, I mean, Microsoft, I think if it was its own country stock market, it'd be like, I think, seventh, you know, in the world. As its own, you know, country stock
GDP,
market.
Right?
Yeah, and I think Stephen mentioned, I believe, you know, the U.S. market makes up, I think, 60% of the all world index. I think is what they call it, the AWICE. You know, there's some acronym for it, but so and if you force me to argue why, I think I could. You know, the best companies in the world are in the U.S.
Yeah,
Microsoft, Nvidia, you know, and on and on and on. So that's partly why they've done what they've done, is because of the earnings and, you know, Meta and things like that they can generate the cash flows. So if the stock market was easy, everyone would do it. Partly why it's so appealing to myself and so many other people is the intellectual stimulation that it provides. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not only, you know, can you be rewarded with money if you get it right, but there is it's fun to try to put the pieces together, and it's ever changing. You get a new piece of information, and this information you had before over here is no longer any good.
Yeah.
You gotta it's like building a puzzle that's always changing pieces. Mm-hmm. And that's appealing to me. I love it.
Mm-hmm. So just to kind of wrap a bow on this market segment, what are you looking for going forward? What signs are you looking for that are going to make you nervous? And what signs are you looking for that are going to be like, oh, you know what? I need to squelch my fears and go in even harder.
Yeah. So for the way I would trade, I need some back and fill. So I think there's going to be a lot of volatility this year. It's an election year. They haven't even considered that. Now, I know it's 10 months away or something, but remember, the market will start looking forward to the election. probably sometime in May or June or something like that. So I think there's gonna be a lot of volatility to the year. And, I'm not going to put some kind of bet down, and cause if I'm wrong, I lose a fortune. And if I'm more of a take it day by day, week by week, just like Bill would say, Bill O'Neill. And I think, you know, there's no perfect way to do it, but that's the best way that I know. So right here, as we sit here now, the market's very extended. It's been very good. If you are, you know, pedal to the metal, I think you're pushing the envelope a little bit. Yeah. I would expect the market to at least test you at some point in the next handful of weeks to months. And so, you know, figure out what you really love. Keep those. Figure out what, you know, you just think, this one's okay. Maybe trim those or sell those and, get down to a manageable level. There's nothing wrong with being 70% long or 65% or 45% in certain situations. That cash creates optionality. You make 5%. Before, you never made anything.
Right. Yeah. At least you've got an option here now.
Yeah. So now, but you make 5%, but you have an optionality that if things get tough and stocks pull back to the 10-week line or they build new bases, that cash can be put to work versus other people who probably don't have that. They don't have that if they stay fully invested all the way and then it comes back. So I think having a little cash is a nice optionality here. You know, I don't think you want to risk all cash because that puts a lot of pressure on you. If you were to get all out, then now every time the market has a good day, you just feel that pressure from not being in. But there's a natural ebb and flow to this that I think a lot of us do it already. And I'm sure a lot of people out there, they do that. Maybe they, you know, for me, it's probably should slow down a little bit. I tend to make those changes a little faster than most people.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's good to understand what makes you change, but also that ability to change. And I think that's something that we drum a lot here, having that flexibility to have a thesis, but recognize when your thesis is wrong and, you know, accept it and kind of move on and change your thesis as more data comes in. So that's going to wrap it up for this market segment. When we come back, we're going to take a look at some of the stocks that are either setting up or things that we can learn from. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with that.
NetSuite by Oracle brings accounting, finance, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce costs everywhere. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/wallstreet.
Welcome back to the Investing with IBD podcast. It's Justin Nielsen here, along with Scott St. Clair, filling in for Arusha Paris. Scott St. Clair, of course, is the premium products manager here at IBD, a position that Arusha used to hold, but he ceded. So Scott is the successor. But let's talk a little bit about stocks. And you mentioned it's been a little bit, you know, tougher out there to find setups. You know, a lot of things are extended, but you know, it's also earnings season. So we've got that to contend with, you know, just as kind of a refresher for folks that are not familiar with your style. How do you handle earnings season, you know, with all of these volatile moves that can happen? What do you do for yourself?
So I tend to just hold them into earnings. I might reduce the position based on, you know, the perceived volatility of the name, what the option market is pricing in for the move that week. But I found that, you know, I used to cherry pick them, and I would, you know, not a surprise, cherry pick them wrong. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, the one I thought would go up would go down, and the one I thought would do nothing would go up. And so I take the good with the bad. You know, if I have 10 stocks that announced earnings this season, you know, hopefully 4 are really, really good. You know, 3 are bad. Let's hope they're not really, really bad. And then, you know, 5 to 7 or 6 or whatever the number is are in between. And in reality is, if I can just survive earnings season, then I've done my job, because it's earning season is tougher. But if you're going to have a big winner, they're just not going to let you sell NVIDIA before earnings and buy it back after four times a year and get all the returns. At least that's been my experience. Somewhere along the way, VRT was a great example of one that I held through earnings. There's a 20% gap on earnings and you're just left in the dust if you don't already have that.
Right. One thing, do you ever look at kind of, I guess, get a sense of the earnings season? Sometimes the early ones out kind of set the tone, and then it's like, oh, you know what? This is an earnings season that seems like a little bit more forgiving when the CFO coughs and, you know, people don't freak out about it. Or, you know, if guidance is not stellar, it's there's just some environments that are a little bit more forgiving. Do you ever kind of change your methodology based on what your perception of that earnings season is kind of early going?
Yes, I think it's very important to observe that. If you don't own XYZ and they report earnings and the street says, or the headlines say, the earnings were great, how did the stock act? Did it act great? Did it act good? If it opened at 200 up 10 and then closes at 195 down 5, that's not exactly the action you would want. So it wouldn't make me change the way I held, but it would definitely contribute to the position size calculator in my brain as far as holding through earnings. Mm-hmm. So if I find that it's a little tougher season, let's say I have 1,000 shares, normally I might go down to 700 or something like that into the earnings. I might go even further, 500, 400, 300, something like that, just because the market is not rewarding, you know, good earnings and or probably punishing, you know, pedestrian to weak earnings. So yeah, how they trade after, like if you had something gap down and it closed unchanged, that'd be great. You survived that. So I would want to know, I would look for that. On how that stock acted.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of earnings, let's go ahead and start maybe with SMCI. And even though this wasn't an earnings that caused this gap up, it was a preliminary guidance. There was an earnings-like move. So again, this is something that kind of you really couldn't prepare for. But you know, what was your take on this move in Super Microcomputer? Earlier this week. Or I guess it was at last week, Friday of last week.
Yeah. So at first I was, I don't want to say disappointed because I didn't own the stock, but I was a little confused by the move in the after hours. I thought the stock should be up more based on the news. Mm-hmm. So the headline was very, very bullish, and the stock in the after hours was up 30 points or something. It was up like 10%. And given the volatility of this stock, I felt like 10% wasn't really that big a move. And so,
given the news, right?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I expected more. And so, a normal person would say, well, it should be up more, therefore buy it because it's going to be up more. Well, it's, for me, I think, well, it's, you know, what does the street know that I don't know? And I didn't buy it, but then it opened and just powered higher all day. I think it was up 35% by the end of the day. And so that was the type of strength that I thought should have had and was looking for. And so therefore I bought the stock at the end of the day, it was a Friday. I bought it near the end of the day. I can't recall exactly how close to the end, but the fact that it was a Friday, like I really love stocks that close really strong on Fridays. My experience is, you have a really good chance that there'll be strong Monday. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily with the idea that I want to sell the strong Monday, but maybe I have a chance to get ahead. I love to be ahead of on it, even if it's just a little bit. So I bought that on Friday. Now it opened crazy up, I think to like 10 or
12%. 10%, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on Monday, which is kind of the other way around. That was much stronger than I expected.
Especially after a 35% move the trading day before, to have another 10% on top of that. Now it's getting a little,
Yeah. So I reluctantly sold into that because that's kind of what I did. And then it, you know, then the volatility really kicked in. It had a really very volatile Monday. I think the high to low is like 85 points or something. So, but it's, you know, barring it's a little stallish today. You don't want to read too much into it, but it's exhibiting the kind of leadership that, you know, stocks that go from 300 to 600, this is kind of how they look when they start.
Yeah.
And so I think it's one of the ones that should be high on your radar if you don't already own it, or if you own it, it's in all the right areas. And I'm, you know, would be really curious to see once they print that number, what that quarterly earnings block looks like.
Yeah. And we were talking with David Ryan, and, you know, actually Jim Ropel was on IBD Live that day. And, you know, he was saying, look, this is one that I wasn't in. I kind of was looking at the base and saying, it's, you know, there's some flaws here. But we were kind of all talking about how much earnings can change, you know, and forgive flaws, right? If you come up with earnings that are that strong. And in this case, again, remember, it wasn't earnings. It was just some preliminary numbers, some preliminary guidance and everything. You know, that changes everything. And you certainly saw that in the chart. David Ryan mentioned that he kind of did take that look at how it was trading in the aftermarket and thought, gosh, based on these numbers, it should be a little bit more. And he actually, I think, bought in the aftermarket. Participated in a little bit of that, you know, maybe not with size, but, you know, to have a little piece of it.
Just get yourself in there. It's always easy, or I think it's much easier to add to a position you have. Mm-hmm. That, you know, initial purchase, which is the hardest part, right? Because you always feel like as soon as you buy it, it's going to stop going up and turn down, right?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like we have that magic power, right? If I had that kind of power, I'd do the other way. I'd buy right. as soon as they were going down, I'd buy them to get them to stop going down, you know?
Yeah. It's almost like we're still teenagers and we think the world revolves around us, right? You know, it's like, oh, the market is looking at what I'm doing and reacting accordingly.
Correct.
Speaking of a thing that we're often all looking at, Tesla, you know, and now this one did have earnings. It looks like, you know, again, this is not necessarily what is going to transpire tomorrow when the stock opens. This is in the aftermarket. It looks like it's down about 4%. You know, Tesla wasn't in an uptrend, you know, I mean, by any measure. You know, you'd have to go pretty kind of far out to kind of see anything uptrendish for this. So what's putting Tesla on your radar at all right now?
Well, I like to have a ballast portfolio of, you know, at least one short.
Okay.
I don't know why, Justin. I think it's just a product of, you know, the 2000 stock market was, mm-hmm. And then the great financial crisis, and you start to develop battle scars from these things. And so the market is so strong, but I always like just have that like my favorite binky when I have a short, you know, it's that kind of offset. If there's any volatility to the downside, I'm always hopeful that that'll offset some, you know, some of my longs. So, mm-hmm. And I have a streak of contrarianism in me, and I just, right or wrong, I've mostly been wrong, but I feel like Tesla is just a very good car company. And if that's the case, then it's going to go a lot lower. And so, and it hasn't, it's been really, gosh, I mean, look at how strong the market has been in the last couple of weeks. And Tesla has just been grinding lower almost day by day by day. And so I don't want to say it's easy, but hopefully anyone who's doing what we're doing, unless you have some super low cost stock, I don't think there's any really real surprise here that the earnings were poor and that the stock is reacting. You know, it's not that negative, but, you know, the stock is down 7-8 points in after hours so far. It's just been a real underperformer relative to all the other leading stocks out there.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing, is when you already have a downtrend in place, it's amazing how I call it confirmation bias, whatever psychological term you want to use, but people start looking for things that are like, oh, okay, well, this is why, you know, it's in that downtrend. And then, you know, you start thinking, and the whole concept of trends is that it's going to continue kind of the way it is until something breaks that. So certainly when you get something that confirms the trend, the downtrend that it's in, it just makes you want to sell more. At least that's what I think in my mind. In the same way that something that's doing well, if it has a blowout earnings, you're like, oh man, this is exactly why it's going up so much and why you need to own more. But of course, at some point, you know, it gets overextended either to the upside or the downside. And so you have to worry about, again, when that change comes. You know, we mentioned earlier with the CPI, you know, the market bottomed when the CPI was kind of the worst and the highest. And it's just kind of a reminder that the market does tend to look forward, months in advance, as opposed to reacting necessarily to what just happened.
Yeah, I mean, if Tesla were to, you know, let's say tomorrow it was unchanged or something after being down 10 or something, that'd probably be a sign that, look, the market kind of knew, for lack of a better word, that these earnings were going to be poor, and the gross margins were really poor. And, 6, 9, 12 months ago, this report would have had that stock down, 25, 30 points. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of people or a lot of institutions probably who's been, maybe they haven't been selling, but they sure haven't been buying that stock while the market's been rallying, right? They've been focused on other areas. So a lot of it is built into, which is why we use charts, why we look at charts. It's just kind of a great picture of supply and demand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Scott, it was great having you on. It's always a pleasure having you on. We'll have you on for a full show again, where we just concentrate on you because we know how you like to make everything about you. But I'm just kidding. But always a pleasure having you on, buddy. Thanks a lot for showing up.
Thanks, Justin. And hopefully Arusha will be back. And
He'll be back next week. And I should mention, next week we're going to have Jeffrey Hirsch on the show. He, of course, is the editor of the Stock Traders Almanac. So by the time that we have him on the show, we're going to have not only the Santa Claus rally, the first 5 days of January, but also the January effect, what he calls the trifecta. So he'll be talking about what that will mean for the potential for the market for 2024, what it means to be in the presidential cycle. We talked a little bit about that. So a lot of that's going to be covered by Jeffrey Hirsch next week. So we really hope you join us for that. Thank you so much for joining us this time around. We'll see you next time.
Make sure to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast if you haven't already. We'd really appreciate it. You can also send us your questions and comments to investingpodcast@investors.com. We would love to hear from you and may use your comments on an upcoming episode. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes only, and nothing should be construed as a recommendation to buy, hold, or sell any securities. Make sure to consider consulting with your financial advisor before making any investment decisions.